Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, that you shall let every girl live." Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. While her attendants walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. Then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. The Gospel of Christ.
Over the first 3 weeks of this academic year, as we have launched into this second year of exploring the narrative lectionary, we've had a whirlwind tour of the book of Genesis, in particular zeroing in on the three great patriarchs of the faith, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And one of the things that we noted about this is that all of them had to deal with infertility issues. And if it wasn't for God overcoming those infertility issues, the nation of Israel wouldn't even exist at all. And so Abraham's wife Sarah was 90 years old, postmenopausal, but because of the intervention of God, she was able to have a child and their son Isaac was born. Isaac's wife, Rebecca, was unable to have children, but again, God opened her womb, and she was able to have her twin sons, Jacob and Esau. Now, Jacob's a bit of an anomaly in the pattern because he had 12 kids through four women, but his favored wife, Rachel, wasn't able to have children for the longest time until once again God opened her womb, and then she was able to have her sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And then she died very quickly after giving birth to Benjamin. But what makes this piece significant is Joseph is the one who is able to go down to Egypt, and because God was with him, he rose to prominence, being the second in command next to Pharaoh, and with his administrative skills, he was able to build a stockpile of food so that when 7 years of famine arrived, the people of Egypt were able to be fed, and also his family living in the land of Canaan, who, because they were starving in this famine, made their way down to Egypt to look for food, and Joseph was happy to feed them. Not only that, to also allow them to live in Egypt in an area called the land of Goshen. And so this family of 70 members has now been saved, once again, because God was at work through Joseph. Well, now we come to the book of Exodus, and we pick up the story a few generations later. We don't know exactly how long it is. There's some suggestions it could be 400 years, 480 years. The point is, Joseph and his brothers, the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel, have long since died, and there's been subsequent generations, and the Israelites have been multiplying in the land of Goshen. And now they are so numerous that you can't help but notice that they're there. And there is now another Pharaoh on the throne who, for whatever reason, didn't ever get told the story of Joseph, which explains why these people were here in the first place. All he sees is a potential liability. His observation is, these people, they're all Middle Easterners, right? There's a lot of them, and this could be bad, because if we were ever to go to war with somebody from the Middle East, you can count on them fighting for the Middle Easterners and not for us. This would be bad. We have to clamp down on these people. And so the first of three things he tries to do is to just simply enslave them and make them work harsh and have no energy for anything else and thereby control the population. But that doesn't work out. God is with the people of Israel. They continue to multiply. So then he says to the midwives who attend the birth of these Jewish children when their mothers, can't call them Jews yet, they're not Jewish, these Israelite women are going to give birth. The midwives were told, look, if a baby is born, kill the baby if it's a boy, but when it's a girl, you can let it live. So that was his attempt. But we're told the midwives feared God, so they didn't do what the Pharaoh said. So then finally the Pharaoh just goes for a nationwide pogrom. And he says to all the Egyptians, look, if you come across a baby Hebrew boy, throw him in the Nile River so that he'll drown. Leave the girls alone, but let's just kill all the boys. And this was his attempt to try to control the Israelites. In the midst of this crisis, we are told the story in chapter 2 about a Levite man and woman, husband and wife. They're descended from Levi, the third son of Joseph, and so they're from that tribe. And they have already had a daughter, but now they have a new baby, and it turns out to be a rather fine boy. So we're told mom hides the boy for 3 months, and then after those 3 months, takes a papyrus basket and seals it up with tar, essentially, puts her three-month-old son into that basket and sets it into the reeds in the river of the Nile, with the sister watching what happens next. Well, it goes downstream, and then the daughter of Pharaoh, who's bathing in the river, sees this basket and goes to check out what it is. She opens it up, and she sees that it's a baby. Aww. And she even sees that it's a Hebrew baby and decides that she wants to keep this baby, even though it's her dad who wants to kill them all. So anyway, the sister shows up out of nowhere and says, you want to keep the baby? If you want, I can get a Hebrew woman to nurse the baby for you. And so the daughter of Pharaoh says, sure, and this little baby goes back to his own mom, who now gets paid by the daughter of Pharaoh to nurse him. Well, once he's grown up, really once he is weaned, he is then brought back to the daughter of Pharaoh by his own mother and says, here's the baby you wanted. And so the daughter of Pharaoh accepts the baby and then says, I will name him Moses, for I have drawn him out of the water. And here we are introduced to perhaps the most significant person in the history of Israel, in the story of Israel. This man, Moses, is one that is referred to so often that he far exceeds anybody else. In the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, the name of Moses shows up 799 times. Now, admittedly, some of those appearances are in the subheadings that were added later into the Bible that weren't really part of the original text. But the point remains, 799 times you see Moses' name in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the three great patriarchs of Israel, their names only show up 726 times in the entire Bible. So Moses is the guy. And he is one who will then go on and grow up to be very, very significant in the life of Israel. But before we start to talk about that, we ought to address something about Moses' story here, just to kind of set the stage again. Again, this is being written quite a while later on when Israel is established as a kingdom. And one of the things we always have to remember is that unless somebody is already royalty or publicly well-known, somebody who's already famous, if you have a child, apart from the immediate family, nobody really cares. And nobody starts writing down the story of that child or anything. The only time we care about somebody's backstory is after they have become significant later in life. So because somebody becomes famous or somebody does something heroic or somebody becomes insanely wealthy or whatever, you know, would you ever care when Elon Musk was born? When he was born, you wouldn't even have known. Now, someone will have written his biography, I'm sure, and we get to find out what little Elon was like. But nobody cared when he was 12, except his own family. Well, it would have been the same for anybody else. But because Moses was identified as a significant person in the story of Israel, let's tell his story. And I would suggest to you that his story was amped up a little bit to kind of help make the significance of this child from the beginning more apparent. Why do I say that? Well, just dealing with the circumstances of what we've described here. The Pharaoh wants to kill all the baby boys by throwing them into the Nile River where they will drown. Moses is born, but his mom hides him for 3 months because she's afraid he might die. But then she takes this three-month-old baby and puts him into a waterproof basket and puts him into the very river that he's supposed to be thrown into to die from. Why is she doing this? We aren't told that she had any idea what would happen. We aren't told that she knew the daughter of Pharaoh would be there. But even if the daughter of Pharaoh would be there, why would you do that with your baby when it's the daughter of Pharaoh's dad who said you're supposed to kill these kids? We get a bit of a hint when we look closely at the Hebrew language. That papyrus basket that he was put into, the Hebrew word for basket used there is the same word used to describe Noah's ark from Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9. And so just as the ark was the means of salvation from death by water that Noah and his family experienced in Genesis, now also we see this little baby being spared from death by the water of the Nile River in his own little ark. A little bit of a connection there thematically. Well, then he is encountered by the daughter of Pharaoh, and the daughter of Pharaoh sees him, identifies him as a Hebrew baby, and doesn't bother doing what her dad said she's supposed to do. Like the Pharaoh is the ultimate ruler. Kill the babies. But she doesn't. She decides she wants to keep him instead. I want to know how she thought that was supposed to work out. Like, was she married? So what's her husband going to say? Hey, honey, where did this extra kid come from? And why doesn't he look like us? In fact, he looks like one of those Hebrew kids. Why are you sheltering him? Or, I don't know what the sexual ethic was in ancient Egypt. Could she pull off being a single mom, maybe? Well, even then, she's living in her father's household. How is she supposed to succeed in raising this child as an Egyptian when she could tell when he was 3 months old that he was a Hebrew? It's just one of those hard things to comprehend. And then on top of that, when this baby's mom comes back with the baby now weaned and gives him to Pharaoh's daughter, it says that Pharaoh's daughter says, "I will name him Moses because I have drawn him out of the water." Well, the Hebrew word Moshe, means drawn or to draw out. So it makes sense why his name would be Moses in Hebrew, but this is an Egyptian princess. Does she even know Hebrew? And why would she give a Hebrew baby that she would want to not have die? Why would she give him a Hebrew name if she's going to raise him in the Egyptian household? Now, there is an Egyptian word that sounds a little bit like Moshe. It's the word Mos, but it means son of. So there's an Egyptian name, Thutmose, which means son of Thoth. Thoth is one of the gods in the pantheon of Egypt. So there is no Egyptian word that sounds like the name Moses. So this is a Hebrew name given to this Hebrew baby by his Egyptian adopted mom. We can see the reason for giving him the name and the circumstances around it, but it's curious how things are laid out like this. I'm just going to simply suggest to you that we are seeing this story being told so that the readers of this book will come to realize this is a significant person. And we should pay attention to what happens next in the life of this guy named Moses. So what happens? Well, things move along fairly quickly. He is raised in the Egyptian household, but discovers he is related to the Israelites. He begins to have a soft spot in his heart for the Israelites who are being enslaved, so much so that when he sees one of them being beaten by an Egyptian, he goes and tries to stop the Egyptian and attacks him and ends up killing him, which is a capital offense. So now Moses, at 40 years of age, takes off out of town for fear of his life. And he goes to the land of Midian near a place called Mount Horeb, which is also known as Mount Sinai, which we'll come back to in a minute. And he hangs out there for 40 years. And then he has an encounter with God. And God says to him, I have a mission for you. I am the God of your father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I want you to go back to Pharaoh and tell him to set my people free. And Moses is reluctant. He's going, why are you asking me to do this? I can't talk very well. I'm not eloquent. How can I hold court with, you know, the leader of the free world? Okay, maybe not so free world, but anyway, how can I do this? And God is basically saying, look, it doesn't matter because, look, I'm the one who's going to be doing the thing. I just need you to be my mouthpiece. And so if you don't like how you talk, then bring your brother Aaron and he can talk for you. But none of this matters. I'm the one who's going to do this for the Israelites, and I want you to be the one to paint the picture for them. And so Moses goes, okay, I will. And so he goes back and presents himself to the Israelites, and they come around to accept him for who he is, and he confronts Pharaoh. The 10 plagues come on Egypt, which is God basically showing that he, Yahweh, is greater than all the gods and goddesses of Egypt combined. And then Moses leads the people out, and God parts the waters of the Sea of Reeds, and they go across, and the waters close on the pursuing Egyptian armies, and they're eliminated. And now the people of Israel have been freed from slavery in Egypt, which becomes perhaps the most significant theme that you see in the Bible afterwards. Over and over again, Yahweh will say to the Israelites, remember that I am the one who freed you from slavery in Egypt. Remember that I am the one who delivered you and gave you this freedom. The Passover, which was the first feast that was given to the Israelites, is arguably the most important one in the entire year that is observed year after year after year. This is a huge event that Israel keeps being drawn back to. Well, they carry on for a couple of weeks and they go to Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, where Moses had already spent 40 years. He's back in familiar territory. He goes up on top of the mountain for 40 days and then he receives the law, the Torah, the Ten Commandments and everything else written on stone by God. And he's the one to carry them down the mountain to deliver them to Israel. And he begins his significant role of not only telling people what the will and purpose of God is for them, reminding them of the covenant that Yahweh has made with Israel, and keeping their minds fixed on following the leading of Yahweh and to fulfill what Yahweh has for them to do in fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham that they would be a great nation and be a blessing to the world. So from there, Moses leads them to the promised land. They're afraid to go in, and God says, okay, fine, if you don't want to go in, you won't. You can go wander around in the wilderness for 40 years, and then once this generation has died off, the next generation can come in and receive this inheritance. And so when that day comes, Moses reminds them of the law one more time, which we'll get into next week, and then hands the baton of leadership off to Joshua. They go into the promised land, and Moses goes and dies in the wilderness. The character of Moses in the story of Israel was all about being a person who would continually bring the people back to realize that Yahweh was their God and no one else, that it is Yahweh who delivered them and set them free from Egypt, that it was Yahweh who made a covenant with them unilaterally to say, you can be my people and fall under my blessing. But if you're going to do that, here's what you need to be about. Here's how you're supposed to live. Here's what you're supposed to do. Here is my will and purpose for you. And for that reason, Moses is a hero to the Israelites. So much so that not only does he become a main character in Jesus' own backstory, because Jesus being born into a Jewish family would have this story as his history, he also makes an appearance in the account that we read in Mark of the Transfiguration, where Jesus goes up on a mountain with Peter, James, and John, and is there transfigured before them, and he is joined by two men, Elijah and Moses. Elijah was understood to be the greatest prophet Israel ever had, and Moses, his name essentially became synonymous with the law, with the Torah. So much so that somebody could say, you know, it says in Moses, honor your father and mother. What it really means is it says in the Torah this particular commandment or that particular commandment, but you could just use Moses' name in place of the Torah, and everyone gets what you mean. And so here on the Mount of Transfiguration, the law and the prophets are represented by these two men, meaning the entire Hebrew Bible is being encapsulated and associated with Jesus. And with that vision, it is clear to the disciples witnessing it, and now to us reading it ourselves, Jesus is the one who now takes the baton from Moses and Elijah, from the law and the prophets, to continue to direct us towards what God's will and purpose is for us. And so in a sense, Jesus takes on the role of Moses, but now in a new way, to do what? Well, for us who are the followers of Jesus, in the same way that Moses would do this for Israel, Jesus is doing this for us, saying, remember that God is the one who is your Savior. Remember that God is the one who is directing you and who is will and who is purpose. Understand, as I've been talking to you, that the kingdom of heaven is like a king who lavishly and generously takes care of those who are in need and pours out blessings on those who are paying attention and calling us to do the same thing, even equipping us to do the same thing for others. And Jesus holds before us God's intention and purpose. We, though, can also put ourselves in Moses' shoes. How? By being honest and thinking about how we tend to view such ideas as being identified as somebody that God has a job to do. We probably would respond reluctantly, as Moses did. Moses, I can't talk very good. God says, doesn't matter. I'm the one who's ultimately doing it. I just want you to do the thing I'm telling you to do. We could say, well, who am I to be somebody to act on the behalf of God? I'm not good at this. I'm terrible at that. I can't talk. I don't have a good vocabulary. Whatever. We have all sorts of reasons why we would say, I'm not really the kind of person you're looking for, God. And yet the answer would be the same. Doesn't matter. God's saying, I'm the one who's doing it anyway. I just want you to be the vessel, the vehicle, the conduit through whom my will and purpose is being communicated, is being demonstrated, and is being shown. And so as Jesus' mission was to communicate what the kingdom of heaven is like, so we are to follow in that way of walking and to be one to remind each other and to invite others to participate in that way of living, in that way of fulfilling the vision God has for the world. In so doing, not only do we fulfill what Jesus was talking about, but by extension, the promise made to Abraham way, way, way back also ends up being fulfilled as the world is blessed through us. And so with these thoughts in mind, we can contemplate how it is we should approach life. What are we looking to do? What kinds of people are we intended to be? What are we being reminded again and again and again to continue to exhibit? Well, to take care of widows and orphans in their distress, to quote the Bible. To consider those who are in need, to recognize that we are to be generous to others. part of fulfilling the call to see the kingdom of heaven realized on earth would be to recognize the importance of things like Orange Shirt Day and realize why we do things like that, to draw attention to an injustice that ought to be recognized as having been unjust, and endeavoring to do something towards some kind of reconciliation. We continue to feed those who are having difficulty, and so there are collections for St. Edmund's Food Bank out there in the narthex that I'll be delivering on Thursday to help those who are in need. We continue to look for ways in which we can serve others for the sake of fulfilling the call that Jesus has given us to see the will and purpose of God accomplished in the world. And what a world it would be if we do it. And so that is why I opened this sermon with one of those three prayers that I always pray, and it was this one. Lord, make us masters of ourselves, that we may become the servants of others. Take our minds and think through them. Take our lips and speak through them. Take our hearts and set them on fire. Amen.